December 10th meeting to order, our workshop. At this time, I'd like to take a moment just to introduce the dais. To my left, I have Mr. Carl Persis representing District 4, Mr. Ruben Colon representing District 5, Mr. Ted Doran, school board attorney. To my far right, I have Mrs. Connie Spire, our agency clerk, and our outgoing, beloved, going to lose agency clerk, and Mrs. Erin Lieben, our new agency clerk. Good morning, Mrs. Lieben. Thank you for joining us. Ms. Jamie Haynes, representing District 1. Mrs. Linda Cuthbert, our vice chairman, representing District 3. Our new superintendent and his very first workshop and meeting, Dr. Scott Fritz. And I'm Ida Wright, chairman, District 2. We're going to move right into our workshop, and Superintendent Fritz, I believe we have 2.01 rezoning.
Yes, ma'am. I'd like to call up Ms. Sarah Lee Morrissey, Director for Planning and Business Services, and Mr. Eric Gazilski, Planning Specialist.
And Mr. Greg Aiken, our Chief Operating Officer, is going to join us.
Sit way over here.
Go ahead. All right. Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the board. Dr. Fritz, welcome to your first meeting.
Thank you.
I hope we don't disappoint you. So to get us going, this morning is a follow-up to the conversations that we had in November regarding two specific rezonings that we were bringing forward to the board to discuss. This particular presentation may or may not address all of your questions and or concerns or comments, but certainly as we move forward with our discussion this morning, should it become necessary to come back and have more detailed conversation about either something we touch on today or perhaps something we've missed, we, of course, will be happy to do that. So moving forward, let's first make sure that we understand attendance zones, because it has been a long time since the school board made any modifications to our attendance zones. The school board has a policy. It's school board policy 202, which addresses attendance zones. In the most simplistic statement, an attendance zone is basically a geographic area that's been designated for students to attend a specific school, and that specific school is based on the student's primary residential address. Why do we have attendance zones? And certainly there are districts and or schools that may not have an attendance zone, may be a total school of choice. But here in Volusia, all of the traditional K-12 schools have an attendance zone associated with it. The attendance zones can help us plan for enrollments, plan to balance not only the enrollments, but the demographics associated with those enrollments. And it helps, it should help us have a somewhat predictable future. And certainly when perhaps we start to see things changing, that may be one of the times where we start to question whether or not there should be a modification to an attendance zone. As I said, it's been a long time since the school board has modified any attendance boundaries, but why would we change those? Certainly, the traditional reason has been because we've built a new school, and there's at least one, if not two or three, schools that are overcrowded, and that new school was built to relieve them, and so we're undertaking a redistricting associated with that. But there's other reasons for a boundary change. Perhaps there's a school closure. Perhaps there's a change in grade configuration. out of school when Holly Hill changed to a K-8. That was combined with the closure of Holly Hill Middle School. And we did quite an extensive redistricting then of the entire Central Halifax area, both at the elementary level and the middle school level. Attendance boundaries and feeder patterns. We're going to talk about that. We've got a good example to show you of whether or not a feeder pattern is deliberately making sense or not. What is a feeder pattern? So the feeder pattern would be that the elementary school zone feeds to school X, middle school, school Y, high school. I can tell you that in Volusia, we have examples of very clean feeder patterns, and we have examples where there are not clean feeder patterns. I'm going to show you one of those today. We also have many examples where a school, an elementary school, could be split zoned to a middle school, meaning the elementary boundary may in fact feed to more than one middle school, may in fact feed to more than one high school, and we have many examples of that. Certainly the demographics of the area, the number of schools in the area, can influence whether or not it's a clean feeder pattern. And as I mentioned, the demographics, balancing demographics, looking at utilization of our schools. I want to say 09, might have been 010, we did a redistricting of the entire Port Orange Elementary School area, South Halifax, and that was solely to balance utilization. We might look at programs. How programs feed to specific schools. Perhaps when we do an attendance boundary change, we need to also look at the feeder pattern associated with specific programs. Needless to say, when we undertake boundary changes, they can be received positively or negatively by our communities. So let's talk a little bit about what some of the impacts are when we're changing an attendance zone. Certainly, there's a number of stakeholders associated with attendance boundary changes. And our students are, of course, our primary. What could happen? Students may go to a totally new environment, a new school. Maybe they know people there, maybe they don't. Maybe their teacher is going to that new school, maybe the teacher is not. Change in transportation route, possibly even a change in arrival time and dismissal time. Certainly when we opened the K-8, some of our families and students saw a change in time going from traditional middle school to now K-8. The school itself. If the demographics change dramatically, it could mean a change in eligibility or lack of eligibility for federal programs, Title I funding. We can see other demographic changes, both in terms of race and or socioeconomic changes, and we try to the extent possible, keep it somewhat consistent with what the community is, but we do have some neighborhoods that are not similar to the community itself, and so then a decision becomes, and we can talk about that on one of our examples, whether or not we're sending students to our closest school or perhaps a school that's further away. Parents in the community, depending on the nature of the rezoning, and like I said, we have a couple of examples here, the process that we use may be different. But certainly a redistricting that impacts a number of our families and students, we will do our very best to provide numerous methods of communication as well as community meetings and certainly advance notice. And then one last piece is working internally within the district. We have a number of departments that can be affected by a redistricting, certainly within the operations department, and in fact, how my relationship with Mr. Aiken began was when he was student transportation director, and we worked on a number of redistrictings together. So we can't move forward without transportation. Ultimately, planning needs to involve Schoolway Cafe, depending on what the numbers associated with enrollment will do. As I said before, federal programs and curriculum in general, working with HR, depending, again, on what enrollment does, what's the implications to staffing. So there's a number of internal departments that we also need to work with. So what I wanted to do at this point is, I always like when I do presentations is to kind of take us clockwise around the county. So I generally do start with our Halifax planning area. And what Eric and I did was we'll talk to you in general terms about the specific planning area, and then we may, where we have an example of something that we either should be considering, if not now, something for the future, we will bring that up and we can have some discussion on that. So let's start with the Halifax planning area. Certainly, if you've driven around, particularly central Halifax, you can see all kinds of signs of the economy booming. We have lots of construction going on in the Halifax area, and in particular central Halifax. Lots of apartments under construction. We have planned for some of that. I know you know, but for the benefit of Dr. Fritz, I may repeat myself in terms of providing the board some information because I want to ensure that Dr. Fritz understands some of what goes on in our communities. So in planning for some of our enrollments, we added capacity at Westside Elementary, and I know you know the new project there. Some of that increase in capacity was looking at Champion Elementary. Champion Elementary is our school west of Interstate 95. It was the replacement for Hearst Elementary. We moved it west. There's also a lot of single-family construction west of 95. There's also a very high number of ESE program units at Champion. So one of the things that we planned for was a movement of our multi-VE students who are at Champion who are zoned to Westside to come back to their zoned school. And that would help us with some classroom space, not as much as I had hoped, but some classroom space. But also recognizing the impact of a lot of those apartments. Those apartments are happening in the Champion Zone, the Westside Elementary Zone, as well as Palm Terrace. So the good thing about that particular type of development, it's spread out. It's not focused on just one school. In the Halifax area, we've been unfortunately impacted by Opportunity Scholarship, and that has necessitated offering transportation. And it's very similar to what existed under No Child Left Behind, the offer for transfers with transportation to other schools. So for the past 2 years, we've done that at Palm Terrace Elementary. I do express a little bit of concern this next summer because we have two schools, Champion and Westside, that if another D letter grade is received, will now have to offer opportunity scholarship at those two schools. So that could influence enrollments and capacities at area schools. Now, I wanted to take a minute to talk about something that now is unique to the Halifax area, and that's the issue of islands. And I'm asking Eric to zoom in. In the core area of Daytona Beach, south of Mason, east of Nova Road, west of US 1, and pretty much north of Bellevue. That is a core area that the attendance zones there are sometimes referred to as islands. They're relatively small attendance boundaries, and these attendance boundaries are associated with a school that is not necessarily the closest school to where these children reside. These attendance zones are reflective of decades of the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education and the efforts of many school districts, including Volusia County, to desegregate our schools. So what you have here are elementary schools, and right now we have about 11 or 12, what I'm going to refer to as islands, within that core area. Now, over the time that Greg and I have been working together, we have tried to address islands to the extent that we can send children to a school that's closer to their residence, and the school that was associated with that island is diverse without requiring an island to make it diverse. So we have made a few changes, but those were opportunities that were associated with our efforts of looking at, I mentioned earlier, South Halifax and Central Halifax when we were doing wholesale redistrictings. We took the opportunity to look at this specific issue, and we just addressed a couple. So we still have quite a few. Okay.
Go ahead.
Is it okay?
Yes.
All right. I want to ask a question prior to the island discussion. When you showed that we're building additional apartments in that area, do we know what type of apartments? Do we know, are they higher priced apartments? Are they going to take Section 8? Do we know what type, you know, are going in?
Go ahead. Do you want to take that?
Yeah. When we do the reviews, the price point is not part of that, but the majority of what is going in along the Williamson corridor is going to be market rate. I am not certain about the area in Palm Terrace off of Dunn. I have not seen enough information on that yet.
To date, usually when the developers are availing themselves of public financing in order to make the apartments affordable, that information is known during the time that they are moving forward with whether it's a zoning change at local government or just site plan, and we do know that. Like Eric said, we've not seen any of the developments to date offer that. Primarily, the focus right now is multi-bedrooms, which, of course, concerns us, and we have seen our student generation rate increase in multifamily, but they're not necessarily being marketed as affordable.
Do we know yet the size that these are going to be, like how many units are going to go into each one?
We can get that information during from the local government once they go through their building permit.
Okay, and then the homes that are being built west of I-95, I'm assuming that they're going into those subdivisions that are already existing there, such as LPGA and the piece that's by Champion and all of that. Is that what we're talking about, the single-family construction?
Yes. On the map here, what is highlighted in yellow are areas that are actively being constructed with single-family. We're showing Minto, or Latitudes,
right,
which is age-restricted, but it's still there, so I wanted to show it.
But it does nothing for us. We don't even get impact fees from Latitudes.
So. Right. I just didn't want to leave it off
right.
In case there was a question on it. Then we have Mosaic that is next to Bayberry and Champion. And we have a couple more infill that have recently come to us. Not infill, part of the LPGA and south of Bayberry, but they're not affiliated with that.
Do we have numbers on how many homes they're looking at building in each of those? And I understand it can be a 3-year, a 5-year, a 10-year phase, depending on the amount of property they have and how they're going to build it out. But do we have numbers yet?
Yes. Every time we do a review, I get the number of units that they're planning on building in that phase. And I did not bring all of the numbers for all of the county, but I do have...
Part of twice a year, and this is associated with our interlocal agreement for public school facility planning with all of the local governments. Twice a year, we meet with the city planners from all the local governments, and one of the required pieces of information from them to Eric is on building permits and certificates of occupancy. Because part of what he's tracking is not just the number that are getting approved, but that absorption and, you know, planning for how the students are going to show up if, in fact, projections are accurate.
So my latest numbers on the west side of 95, the single family there, was about 1,077. That is previous numbers. I'm not sure what the current is today. This was from our meeting in October, I believe, with our...
With the planners.
Planning organization.
So you said 1,077 single-family homes being built in that highlighted area that's west of 95.
Correct. And that is okay. Not 1,077 homes under construction right now.
Right.
That is,
I understand that.
1,077 planned for, yes.
Now, does that number include Latitudes, or does that number just include...
That is outside of Latitudes.
Outside of Latitudes, okay.
Yeah, because I believe Mosaic is about 680 homes that will be going to Mosaic. The remaining should be going to LPGA, and if they decide to finish developing some of Bayberry, there may be another 125 in there. So.
May I ask one more?
Sure.
So now on to the islands. I think to be clear, since... some of us here understand the islands, and some people don't know anything at all about the islands. I think we need to be give a little bit more details about the islands so that everybody truly has a real picture of what's happening there. And, you know, my understanding of it is there we have Campbell Middle School and Turie T. Small sitting there, and the streets right, you know, in front of Campbell Middle. I mean, I watched it happen years ago when I had to drive into EDC. You have 10 homes, and these four kids walk to this corner and get on a bus. You know, these four walk to this corner, and these four walk to this corner and get on a different bus going to a different school, and these two may just get on a bus, or they may get to stay in their neighborhood. Because you said we're still at 11 to 12 schools that we are busing just that few streets out to.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What's hard for me, and what's always been hard for me on that, is that we chose to put them out at so many schools. So we can be living right next door to each other, and I walk this way and get on a bus and go to Tomoka. She walks that way and gets on a bus and goes to Horizon. So we don't even go to school together, but then we come mm-hmm. back home, and we spend more hours at home and in our neighborhood together, but we don't attend school together. So I just have struggled with the way, I mean, I know why it was done, just the why so many schools? Like, because to me, we're taking apart a community
mm-hmm.
by doing that. Like, why couldn't we just say, okay, at least everybody on this side of the street or whatever, at least all go to the same elementary school together mm-hmm. instead of, you know, we're at different, we don't see each other all day and then we come home and
mm-hmm.
play. But that's just, and I know that's Ida's district. But,
I'm the chair, so I'm keeping all my comments to the end.
But, you know, I drove in and out of that neighborhood every day for several years and I watched those students. You know, and I just, because how do we build a community
mm-hmm.
when, you know, four of you go here and five of you go there and six of you go here and mm-hmm. and we're not building a community. So that's just my opinion on that.
Colleagues, do you all have any more comments on this particular, at this point? No? Carl, no? Linda?
No.
Okay. So I will deal with Halifax while we're here. This has always been a bone of contention for me. First of all, I don't like calling them islands. They don't live on an island. They live in Daytona Beach. I hate that.
Yes.
But that's just me. And we do. We have children. If we look at this map, it's probably the only place where we really do bus children to help with diversity. And that's really unfair to those neighborhoods. It's unfair to the children because they leave there and they either go to Port Orange Elementary, Horizon Elementary, Tomoka Elementary, Champion Elementary, Pathway Elementary, because my children went to Pathway, a 45-minute ride to and from home. That's an hour and a half. And I don't care what nobody at this day says. That's unfair to those children, especially the elementary. And I understand diversity. I truly understand. I understood the intent of the law, but most people really don't understand. So I'm gonna educate you a little bit. The reason the law came about is because the young lady was bused out of her neighborhood. She was not allowed to go to the school in her neighborhood. Then when we had the segregation, one of the big issues was they didn't allow the principals and the teachers who were at the segregated schools to go to predominantly white schools. Currently, of all the teachers in America, 4 million in public school, only 6% of them are minorities, where at one time it was 37%. So when we decided to do segregation, it actually negatively impacted African American communities
mm-hmm.
because they did not allow the teachers and the principals to go with the children when they wanted to help segregate schools, and we're right back where we started. And I know many proponents are saying, you know, well, we're going back to segregation. It's not that we're segregating. I just think children in elementary school should be educated in their communities, and they should look and be able to reflect. It has nothing to do with race. I just want the best teachers. And so when we talk about schools in this area, if we had the very best teachers, the very best resources, they would perform just like any other school. And so I don't know how the rest of you feel, but I really, Sara Lee and Greg and Dr. Fritz, we really need to look at this. That was one of my things when I came on the board. I did not like the fact that our children in 32114 had to be bused all over Volusia County, and yet we're not busing anybody back in to help segregate those schools. They're still all predominantly black. We're not busing any white children from Ormond or Port Orange or New Smyrna to any of those schools to help with segregation. So I don't know if we're really being and not you, I just don't know if we're being genuine when we say we want to segregate schools, because it's not being reciprocated on any other platform in this county.
So, as always, when there's a topic that's new to me, I have to do a lot of research, and I've done a lot of reading as it relates to exactly what you're talking about there. And there are, when we talk about rezoning, you know, looking at top districts in the country who have gone through this, they have gone away from a map type of rezoning to a socioeconomic kind of rezoning. And exactly what you're describing is exactly what they are talking about. And it's not the sending them out, it's the fact that there's not that balance. And so, you know, while I appreciate the presentation and I've gone through it and I've had a real hard time because I didn't even realize how many of my kids. I've never really seen a true map, and try finding one. It's kind of hard, and I'll get with you. We can get offline on that one. But, you know, when we talk about the rezoning, I'm not even thinking geographically. And if you and I'll share these articles that I've been reading where they – it is not, okay, this block of schools goes here. It is who is in that block. How is that going to impact? How is that going to, is it going to bring it up? Is it going to bring it down? Who are the students? What's the true data that's driving the decision versus just the map? And you hit a good point, because the reality is that the intent was to not have the same schools, you know, kids in the poverty in their neighborhood, but there has to be that balance. And I usually try to stay my world in Deltona, Enterprise, and Osteen. But when I have been to Turie T., I've been to Westside, I've been to those schools, and one of the principals said to me, Reuben, think of your poorest school. And so I thought of my poorest school. They said, your poorest school looks nothing like this. And it's not only its facilities, it's cleanliness, it's, and so there's a lot of things that play. And so as I've done a lot of reading, the map probably in this day and age has least to do with the rezoning than the actual folks who are going to be affected. And so, you know, I've shared this with Dr. Fritz, and he's agreed to take it back to the team, because what I said was, I want to see an independent from our curriculum department report on how these changes will affect. I've spoken to my principals, who of which had no idea this was even a conversation, and they shared with me some of their concerns and opportunities, et cetera. And so I think that if we have that look at it, other than here's a map, okay, we have too many kids here. I mean, Champion, you know, why is Champion where Champion is right now? We're not going to say that out loud, okay? However, the reality is to think that a kid's going from Turie T. all the way to Champion, and what I learned about Champion is they have to go, if they want to do something at the school, we literally should be sending buses to pick up those parents so they can come participate at their kid's school. And so, again, not getting on the soapbox, I agree with Ms. Hain, I agree with you. It's just, I just think that the way we need to look at this rezoning, if we're going to cross that bridge, is totally different than we ever have. And there's a lot of data out there to support, you know, different thought processes other than geographic. That was all.
Okay, thank you.
So, I agree, but there's a few pieces I disagree on, and this is where I come back to. Our kids have a right to be educated with the children that they live with. No matter where I've lived, I have moved my kids to whatever the school is in that zone when they were growing up, because I wanted them, when they came home, to be able to play out in the yard or next door with the neighbor's kids and have those relationships. And the other thing I can tell you is, all those years that I did summer programs and had to work with transportation on the feeder patterns for summer programs, my biggest thing has always been not having students on a bus for extreme lengths of time, because little kids riding a bus for 45 minutes or an hour is not the answer. But the heartbreaking piece is, I was at Freedom Elementary one summer, and a mom walked in, and she said, this is one of the schools of choice, so I'm going to choose next year to put my child at this school. And I said, so why are you making that choice? Like, are you displeased with the school that you've been at? She goes, no, I love the school we're at. I love the teachers. I'm like, then why are you choosing to move your child? My child's going to be on the bus for an hour and 20 minutes approximately. I won't need after school care. Okay, we have got to put children first in whatever decisions we make. Kids need to be close to home, in my opinion. And you guys can tell me, I mean, you can. We can agree to disagree. But think of when you grew up. I mean, I lived in a lot of different cities in the early part of my life because of what my father did. But I wasn't going to make friends with somebody at school that then lived in a whole different community, and not, I wouldn't see them until I went back to school. You know, think about what you just said about, we bus kids out to Champion, but yet their parents can't get there for activities because they don't have a way. It's like our McGinnis families. Like, if we were to close McGinnis Elementary, and I've heard rumors of that effect, and I don't agree with it, and bus those kids either north to Pearson or south into DeLand, how are those families going to get to the school for the activities? Like, I think we've got to look at our kids and our families and what works for them, because we've got parents out there that have no form of transportation. Go ahead.
And so I agree with what you're saying in my heart of hearts, but the reality is that the evidence shows something different.
And again, in
healthcare, when they come up with something that's evidence-based, you know, a lot of times it makes me cringe because it's like, but this is the way we've always done it. But the evidence shows that students, when they go to a better-performing school, do better. Students, and so, again, I think, and so what I would enforce is to try to strike that balance of the two, and I think Ms. Wright made a very good point. You know, yeah, you're sending some of them away, but the majority of them are staying there, and we're not, there's no integration. There is no balance. There is no uncomfortable balance. I'll use that term, because this is a very sensitive subject. It's something that I almost don't want to say a whole lot on, even though I haven't shut up. But you know, the reality is that, and I shared the article with Dr. Fritz on via email, and if he sees appropriate, he could share it with the rest of us, because I know this is something we may be voting on. But the evidence supports that socioeconomic versus geographic, you know, test scores and all that good stuff. So, again, it's striking that balance. I just, again, looking at this presentation, and again, this is not to you all, this is kind of the way we've always done it. I think we could challenge the thought process.
And so with that said, I do want them to finish, but I'll say this. I think I could find actually research to support anything any of us are saying.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter, let's deal with the realities we have in Volusia County. And so when you have children who live, who go to school in Horizon, they can't stay after school. They can't get tutoring. The parents can't go to the summer program. I mean, go to the evening programs. So socioeconomic, race, gender, whatever it is, we got to do what's best for our children.
Right.
And so with that in mind, I still think, you know, we were supposed to have some center set up where the children who were bussed out were able to come back and then have tutoring, and we've yet to do that. And so when we start redirecting money, and I can guarantee you, if we looked at what we're doing, transportation, we'll save some money in transportation, we probably need to then take that money and reinvest in the schools. And if we need to build a new Turitis Mall, if we need to build a new Stark Elementary, we may need to be really looking at some of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, bringing in the best and brightest.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we've never asked who would like to work in some of our low-poverty schools. It does. It takes a unique person. But I will tell you, based on our meeting in Tampa and listening to the superintendent in Miami, it can be done. It really can be done. But we got to find people, first of all, who love kids and really understand that regardless of their race and where they're from and their socioeconomic, they can learn. And if we believe in them, I think we can eliminate some of the busing just by getting and finding people who love children. And that is a task. And I know that's hard. Everybody's looking for teachers. Many people are getting a profession because they need a job, not because they love children. And so we do, we have several obstacles, but I want to go back and let you finish. Thank you.
I appreciate all of the comments that we're hearing because certainly we share the concerns that we've heard. And we also know that there is no single answer to the issue, which I think has also been expressed. And what has evolved, and I too am very interested in the articles, and there's a lot being written about this, and there's communities outside of our area that are really spending time on this issue and trying to determine the path that they want to take. But the underlying thing for us to consider as we move forward is, or the thing that I always come back to when I think about this, is ultimately the families that are impacted, they may or may not agree, and the issue of choice, I think, needs to be part of how we look at this, because there is no right or wrong on this. I want to take you to the next slide and talk about something that is going to need to come forward at some point. And while we look at this one, I am going to take the time to show the board what Mr. Aiken and I, and of course other staff, but you know, we at the time we were in the leadership positions, how we tried to address some of what I've heard from the board as it relates to creating zones so that our children can attend a school that's not only closer to them, but also with the children that are in their neighborhood. So the next couple slides, two slides, I believe, reflect some of the issues that are associated with us evaluating the Osceola and Ortona consolidation associated with the Osceola Master Plan project. And a couple of things surface when we are looking at attendance zones in this area. So let me focus first on the middle school issue, and then the second slide will be our high school. But it's the middle school issue for Osceola. Well, first I should mention that both Osceola Elementary and Ortona Elementary have attendance zones that are in the core area of Daytona Beach. Eric, if you could please. The northernmost zone, which is just off of Mason. That one, yeah. That zone is Ortona. The one that is just off of Orange Avenue to the south, that is Osceola. What is somewhat interesting when I looked at the different attendance zones for the entire subject area is that on the beach side for Osceola Elementary, all of the beach side that is zoned to Osceola goes to Ormond Beach Middle School and Seabreeze High School. The zone for Osceola that is in the core area, south of Orange Avenue, goes to Campbell Middle School, which is the closest middle school, and goes to Spruce Creek High School. Now, when we look at Ortona, the Ortona beachside area is a much smaller area than Osceola. And it's interesting. The area that is south of Plaza Boulevard, which is one of the roads that Seabreeze High School bounds itself, that Ortona area from Harvard to Plaza is zoned to Ormond Beach Middle School and zoned to Seabreeze High School. South of Plaza, the area all the way down to Seabreeze Boulevard is zoned to Campbell Middle School. The zone that's off of Mason, Ortona's zone here, that area is zoned to Ormond Beach Middle School. Now, I want to take a moment to talk about the middle schools here because this was an area where Mr. Aiken and I did some of the comments that you just made. This was an effort that we made because we recognize and share the concerns to make some changes. So if you could zoom in, please. That area that is immediately south of Mason, okay, and it goes all the way to Engram, bounded by US 1 and Nova. That used to have, I believe, three different middle school boundaries within that block. That area now is entirely zoned to Ormond Beach Middle School. Taking that comment that was made about if you're going to send children to a school that is outside of their immediate neighborhood, at least ensure that they are going to that school with the children that are in their neighborhood that they're hanging out with. Now I want to, if you look over there, one of the other things that we took the opportunity to do at this time, and this was associated with Holly Hill, was the Hinson zone was a very small area that actually was immediately adjacent to Campbell Middle School. And so we took the opportunity to change that so that the area that immediately surrounds Campbell now attends Campbell. And we took an area that is just south of LPGA off of Jimmy Ann, across the street from Westside Elementary. And Westside Elementary was one of the elementary schools that had a split zone middle school. Some of it was Hinson and some of it was Campbell. So what we did was we took the opportunity to create an area that was much closer to Hinson and send that area to Hinson. So in the time that we have had to work together on these kinds of issues, we've tried to look at it and address it to the extent that we've been able to. But following through on the rest of the conversation as it relates to, zoom out and hit the next slide, please.
Excuse me, before you move forward, go back to the Mason Avenue where you have Osceola.
Ortona.
Because I think that's what Jamie's saying. You have carved out, but that entire beige area is actually homes and apartments.
Correct.
So why is it that all of those children within that geographical area are not, if we're going to bus to Ortona?
No, good point, valid point. All I'm showing you how it exists today.
Right, I understand. But I think that is the question we're asking because you bring them back from elementary for them to all then reconvene for middle school versus having them all go to elementary and then let them disperse for middle school because I think it's more adaptive and parents are not as engaging. I shouldn't say that, but some of them are. But they are not as engaging in middle and high school as they are in elementary.
Understood. And your point is a really good one because in this evaluation of this potential consolidation, we could have the opportunity to reduce the number of zones in that area and have them all go to one single elementary and then feed to the same middle school. And certainly one of the things that we've also looked at, some of these families lack transportation, independent transportation. And some of the schools that these students and their families are assigned to are not on a VOTRAN route. And so that's another thing, you know, we can look at, and certainly both Ortona and Osceola happen to be very close to VOTRAN bus stops, but that would be another piece of looking at how do you ensure whatever school children are assigned to can be accessible.
Okay. Excuse me. Yes, go ahead.
So right there in the part that you have zoomed in on, you're showing the section that goes to Ortona out of there. And I agree with Ida. Mm-hmm. I've hated the whole word island. And you've got the group going to Osceola. And so there's basically 10 or 11 more little sections in there going out.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we even look at it, so the tan area is going off to Henson.
Yeah, that these pink, are middle school zones,
right,
on this map.
The pink is going to Creekside.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Is it Silver Sands for that kind of teal
yes.
blue?
Yes.
And then Campbell Middle. I mean, just look at what we're doing to these kids and their families. And that's been my argument. I mean, thank you for, like, cleaning up some of Westside Elementary and putting those kids at Henson versus splitting them to Campbell. But just even, and I know we're looking at a map and it's not realistic, but just the driving time. Like, if you go down to where you've got the Osceola little group you're pulling out, that driving time, because those... That area is not beachside. Like, they've got to cross the bridge even to get to beachside to go up there. So, I don't know. It's just my feeling is, are we, number one, have we made these decisions based on what's best for adults or bus routes or, you know, whatever, or building, or have we made the decisions based on what's best for students? Because I'm going to go back to this. When it comes time for summer programs, all of a sudden, we ignore where we bus them to for elementary, and we bus them to their closest zoned site for summer. So Osceola kids don't get bused to Tomoka, which would be the summer site for Osceola. They go to Turie T or South Daytona. So you guys need to understand that. We don't bus based on the islands for summer. We bus for summer kids to their closest zone school. So that child may have sat at Osceola for 5 years, and in fifth grade now, they're going to go to summer programs, and Tomoka is holding it because we, you know, we geographically rotate, and Tomoka's holding it. Well, we don't bus them to Tomoka with the kids they've been with that whole time. We bus them to Turie T or South Daytona because we bus them to their closest geographical location. We choice is off the table, so if they've been bused for choice, we don't bus choice during the summer. So we do one thing during the summer, we do another thing during school year, and I'm not against what we do in the summer, okay? But I'm just saying, we just have all these different things going on that, you know. Because why do we do that during the summer? It makes sense. There's less time on a bus. It saves a whole lot of money. Lots of money is saved during the summer by them being bused to the closest location.
You know, it just almost seems like we've got to go back to the drawing board somewhere here. And I don't know how, I mean, it almost sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, we're fixing one problem here and that creates another problem there. Of course, we're chasing construction, we're chasing growth. I mean, we're back in a growth stage in our economy now. And so at what point do we look at what's going to be from, like Ms. Haynes said, whether it's tomorrow or the next 10 years, and try to look at it in that scope versus okay, we need to fix this part of town. Like, I'll give an example with the Enterprise, and I know that's not the subject right now, but the minute Orange City puts up all these, you know, sells another parcel of land, puts up another 200 houses, we'll be back here again. And
well,
so
I think that's the purpose of this, to give us an idea of where the growth is taking place so we can make some decisions. And so hearing this, I think we will have to make some decisions into just giving them some direction. You know, we really want you all to go back to the drawing board. And I think that is part of our purpose for today.
Absolutely.
In addition, we know the 2020 census will play a major role in some of this. We need to be mindful of some of that and some of the boundary lines and all of that that will take place. But in addition, we talked about choice. The district needs to think about having our own choice schools. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about competition. Mm-hmm. We don't have to necessarily have competition. We need to look at where we are and what can we do as a district to provide choice to our families. Mm-hmm. Because we, too, have the same right to have our own choice schools and magnet schools and programs. Because mm-hmm. I will tell you, for my area, I really do believe we should have some IB or Cambridge elementary schools. Because you have high-performing children everywhere. Continue.
So
yes, go ahead.
I was just going to make the comment you said on choice. Currently, right now, policy 203 with choice, it's the parent's responsibility to get them to the closest established stop into the school. A true choice would be transportation, no matter where you live, to where you need to go.
Right, but when we say choice, I think often, you know, we look at it as a negative connotation.
Correct.
I'm just saying, as a district, we have the right, and we have really the responsibility that we could create choice within our own district.
You're right.
Just so that our children can have some flexibility.
And you're right.
Oh, yes, go ahead.
I do have a question. Thinking of the Ortona Osceola consolidation, since, you know, I've gone through the selection committee with you on this. If we create a middle school on the new campus, mm-hmm. if we agree to consolidate these two elementaries, there is an opportunity to create, because I have seen in the past, because I too have a beachside elementary who has to go across the bridge and goes fairly far to a middle school. Be nice to be able to create a unique magnet middle school at that campus mm-hmm. for those beachside kids who have to travel so very far for choice. Mm-hmm. It's an opportunity for us. My question is, would we then, when those kids graduate from the eighth grade, would they have then the opportunity to either attend Seabreeze or Mainland? Is that when they would start to kind of break up and choose? Because, you know, some children are coming from the southern part of the Ortona geographical area. Would they be given the ability to choose? Because Seabreeze has Cambridge program. Mm-hmm. I don't think Mainland does. So
correct.
They would still have, but they would have to go all the way to Spruce Creek High School for an IB program.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be kind of interesting to see if we allow those students who could have that K through 8 in a new site, on the beach side, a new magnet program, to have innovation and creativity, especially for beachside students, and then have that choice that they can go either to Seabreeze, Spruce Creek High School, or Mainland for their academies, whether it's finance or medical, or whether it's engineering. So many opportunities then that they can be prepared for when they have that mindset to go into the ninth grade.
And certainly in the Halifax area, there is a lot of movement at the high school level. For the purposes of programs and choices. That exists today.
Yeah. But I just thought if we should state about the opportunities. We always talk about our land-based, our mainland schools.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really discussed, we don't have a whole lot on beachside, but our beachside elementaries and our students and families are very unique because coming from New Smyrna High School, we knew there were other communities. We had a beachside community. We have a Samsula agricultural community. We have a mainland community. But, you know, surfers and ag students sometimes mix, sometimes they don't. So I just think it's a wonderful opportunity to highlight our beachside students and that particular culture and family, socioeconomic level.
Yeah.
I'm lost. So was this something prior to us coming to the board that they had discussed consolidating these? Because I know Carl mentioned it when we were talking about it, and I remember cringing like, ooh, did he just say that? But was this something that
prior to you coming to the board? Yes, we've talked about it because both schools are extremely small.
Okay.
And they're within 2 miles, or within 3 miles. You can live there and walk to either school.
Yeah, I went to Osceola. I visited Osceola.
Actually, your visit was after the board conversation about the consolidation at the budget workshop on June 6th. We had shown 3 separate projects for Osceola as part of the budget, and I had mentioned to the board that the Project Oversight Committee had talked to us as staff about those 3 projects and that they didn't think it was moving forward in terms of taking this whole community into the 21st century, and it was at June 6th where the board gave us the direction.
Right. I know we talked about it prior, but since both of you've been on the board, we've had that discussion, and and during that we talked about possibly K-8. But there are several elementary schools on the beachside because we also have Long Street, we have Coronado, and we have what else?
Ortona, Osceola, and then Coronado.
Okay.
And then now those are the elementaries.
Right, right.
We've got Seabreeze High School and Riverview Learning Center.
Right, right. Just a minute. I want to make sure, Ruben.
Yeah, no,
are you
clear? That's good, yeah.
Okay, Carl, and then I'll come to the two of you.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure. That's funny that you brought that up because I wanted to try to make sure everyone is on the same page with this Ortona Osceola thing. And just thought you may want to share with them again, you know, what we, our visits to the faculty. Mm-hmm. And the field trip that is planned, and mm-hmm. so that everybody is aware, I think that would be good.
Yeah, the Ortona Osceola direction, that is part of the bond program now. Mm-hmm. And we have met with both SACs, and I have met with both SACs, and I have met with both faculties. Mr. Persis joined me at, I believe it was the faculty meeting that I attended. I have had the conversation at that level. Right before school started, we met with both principals from both these elementary schools to tell them, you know, this had been the conversation, this is how we will evaluate and move forward. On your agenda tonight is the committee selection recommendation to begin the process. In the RFQ, is that both school sites need to be evaluated, condition assessments done at both campuses, and conceptual plans for both a K-5, a consolidated K-5, traditional K-5, as well as a potential K-8, because we heard that from the board as well, need to be evaluated to determine what can fit on either of these properties, what is the implication. And I have invited through the school principals, the faculties and the SACs from both schools to a field trip. It's optional, it's voluntary, on December 19th, next week, to Chisholm Elementary, so that they could see the most recent school.
Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to continue with what I was saying. I know a little bit more because I am on that committee. I'm on that selection committee. And so I heard of, we had four architectural firms.
Was who we interviewed.
Yeah, we interviewed 4 architectural firms who discussed the lands. Now, both of these elementary schools, as Carl very well knows, and so do you, are very much ravaged by hurricane hurricanes, the weather, beach erosion. It's very expensive to keep up. I know because I see all the work that has to be done at Coronado Elementary and Longstreet Elementary. But these two schools are older, and they definitely need some attention. So what was discussed in that selection committee meeting was the condition of the facilities. Is it feasible to join them? Is it feasible to have a K through 5? Is it a possibility for K through 8? And also servicing those students. We also discussed, you have a very long Brevard County looking district like this. One is in Ormond and one is in Daytona. So we know there's some restrictions with municipalities. But when it comes down to it, can we serve our students and can we serve our families? But we need to study it. We needed to go into it and say, is this feasible? Because otherwise, and Mrs. Morrissey went on with board direction from June to start investigating it. Because how do we know unless we hire an architectural firm and also talk to civil engineers, plumbing and electrical engineers, as well as, I mean, I asked questions about intrusion, water, how far are they away from the beach, what kind of windows and paint is going to be used. So if we do rebuild them, can we build a facility that is longer lasting, especially as we deal with climate change? But I do not think we would be doing a disservice to the families on this beach side to address their situations as well.
Okay.
But we had to investigate.
Yeah, just to follow up, and I don't want to keep beating it up, but we just wanted to go slow mm-hmm. with this because the rumors were starting to come out in like August. And so when I was asking, you know, folks about it, they, oh, yeah, the school board's already made up their mind. And I'm just like, no, you know. So I thought, you know, we better get out in front of this, you know, and hire a firm to study both of the sites and go to the faculties and the SACs and let them ask questions as many, as often as they wanted to let them know that just a couple of things. You know, Osceola was built in 55. I think Ortona was 51. Ortona's, what, about 10 acres, and Osceola's 13?
11 and 13.
You know, is it going to be a K-5? Is it going to be a K-8? You know, all those things haven't been decided, but until we get the report from the engineers to advise us, number one, which site would be the better site to build a new school, any new school. And then secondly, if we wanted to build a K-8 school, is there room? Is there enough just physical space to build a proper K-8 school? Because as Dr. Fritz knows, you have many K-8 schools, and you all like leaders in K-8. So if we're going to do it, we want to do it right.
Right.
And to whoever said it about the magnet school, you did. Yeah, it would definitely attract people to live on the beach side if there was a middle school on the beach side. We don't have a middle school from Ponce Inlet to Flagler County line.
So where do they go now?
So they go to Ormond Beach Middle School.
Or Hinson.
Or they go to Campbell.
Or Hinson.
Or they go to private schools.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a splintered thing. So that's kind of, if I'm misspeaking here, just correct me. But that's why we kind of do it just, maybe it seems really slow, but I think we kind of learned a little bit through the years here. Let's just take it slow, make sure everybody is engaged and can ask their questions, and, you know, the board hasn't made a final decision, and everybody can get a chance to weigh in on it. So I just wanted to offer that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Haynes?
Okay, so granted, Mr. Colon and I are newer, and you guys had discussion about this prior to us being on the board. And maybe here's a piece I just don't understand, the procedures that are followed when you're going to do something like this. But you know, when it was said during the summer, at first I kind of felt like I didn't know there had been conversation. Just because of the way you said it, Mr. Persis, at the meeting, it's just kind of you threw out there, oh, maybe we should combine them and maybe we should turn it into a cake. And I'm not against any of that, okay? My concern is that I've heard coming out of that community about the SAC meetings and the faculty meetings, and I didn't know that we were going in to talk to the SAC teams and the faculty team, and just tell them this was what was happening because we hadn't made a decision. And there's a difference between saying this is what's happening and, oh, by the way, we're already selecting architects and all that, and then we come back here today and we're going to vote on this later this afternoon, and yet now we're kind of having a conversation that it's reality. Maybe it's just me, but it's like, and I didn't understand the procedure or steps when we want to do something like this, but it kind of seems out of order for me that we would walk into a SAC meeting and say at Osceola at a SAC meeting, here's what's happening. You know, we're going to combine you and Ortona before a decision really has been made. And we really didn't talk about it much as a board. It was just kind of a statement, and I'm not against it.
No, no, no. I understand, but I think you got a misconception. I believe, and I'll let you speak, but I think we went, because I know my principal contacted me about what they heard at the school board meeting. And so what we said, or what I said, and I know Mr. Persis then went with Sarah Lee, you know, we're having a discussion because both schools are in a position that they either need to be replaced or major renovations. And this is the time for us to have these types of conversations. Yeah. But I turn it over.
Yeah, that's it. This gets back to that summer when we were deciding, remember, to renovate Osceola or replace Osceola. And then it got down to, well, who decides whether it needs to be totally replaced, and right. That's going to take some kind of an architect or engineer to advise us. And then I think once it went to that point that we're going to have to do something at Osceola, mm-hmm. and it sounded like we were going to renovate every single building, then it was like, well, why don't we just build a brand new school? And then it got into that part, and then once we started, and that's why this first SAC meeting was held, not so much that we were closing Ortona, but we got great news. You're going to have a brand new Osceola Elementary School. I mean, if like nothing happens, Osceola is going to have a brand new school. So we were getting them, you know, that kind of information. The Ortona part was kind of just like a piggyback along that. And so then we said, well, if we're going to hire the firm to tell us what we can and can't do at Osceola, we might as well do it at Ortona too, because Ortona, you know, you got to understand, Ortona has 200 students. Osceola is a little over four.
It's on either side of 400, depending
on
the year.
So, you know, it was like, golly, you know, we don't want to exclude Ortona in any of this conversation, and that's what we were just trying to do, to make sure Ortona and everybody at Ortona had the same information that Osceola had, so that they all got a clear understanding, not from Facebook and not from, you know, anything else, but from Sarah Lee.
Yeah. Reuben?
And so looking at the minutes from June, what it says, Ms. Wright, mm-hmm. six, Ms. Wright requested that Ms. Morrissey bring back the board the cost for Deltona Middle, Tomoka Elementary, and then Osceola K-8. And so, you know, arguably, you know, I don't, like, and again, this is just may be me not knowing how this all works. And, you know, again, this is on the other side. I have to map quest what this even looks like, because I've only been to Osceola, and I know they have a lot of field back there. But I think that, you know, again, I probably would have expected it to have come back, and then we would have talked about it, which I guess is what we're doing today. So,
And we still haven't looked at the cost. And the only reason we talked about it, Kate, I think both of you hit it. We don't have a middle school, and that's probably one of the major complaints that we have on the beach side. At one time, we had Seabreeze Middle.
Yeah.
And we closed Seabreeze. And they had a seventh grade center. So we used to have a seventh grade center, middle school. And so now we really do need to really have the conversation. And like I said, when I spoke with Ortona, it was more so, this is where we are. This is the time that we need to have some hard discussions. It may come out where we have an elementary one place and a middle school another. We don't know. But we need to find out from the architects what we can do, where we can do it, and how we can do it. Linda and then Jamie. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Remember our policy, and we've gone through this several times, and it's to help educate. And also Dr. Fritz as well, what we've done. What we did is we had a conversation about the possibility. Mr. Persis brought it up. Mrs. Wright asked for the cost. It takes time to start looking and doing the bids and getting firms to come in and getting a time set up when everybody can meet to analyze it, plus all of her staff as well. And then what happens is the selection committee chooses the firm. We have a recommendation, comes before the board, and we vote for the firm to start looking into it, pricing it, what's feasible. And in this case, is it the 11 or the 13 acre? But not only just the acreage, but what is the shape of the acreage? It might be that the 11 acre, the smaller shape, is more conducive for building and for parking, for parent pickup, for accessibility from the streets. So once that's done, so almost a year, 6-8 months can go by, 9 months can go by for the study. And then it's brought before the board again. And we look at it, we examine it, we say, okay, let's go ahead and continue. And what they'll start to do is start picking out, you know, start looking at subcontractors. What's the paint? And I remember the board you brought forth for us for Pearson Elementary, all the tile and the material, and it was a big, huge discussion. It was making it real. But not until we are ready to build, to make the decision to build it, and we have the money in the bank, does the master schedule come before the board, and then we vote on the dedication of the money, and that's when it starts to go.
It's in the capital budget. This was the Osceola Master Plan.
Yeah.
Whatever shape it ends up taking is part of your COPS.
Right. We've already allocated that.
The issue is, where are we going to land? Exactly. And we don't know where we're going to land. We need to study all of these different things.
Right. Ms.
Okay,
Haynes.
So I think where I'm actually at with this, because as I said, when Carl threw it out there, I wasn't opposed to it. I know where both schools are. I know the condition and, you know, how old they are and everything. I think, and this is my perception, I think what's happened here is we've got three board members that understood what was going on and maybe knew there were faculty meetings and SAC meetings and all this going on. And we got two board members, and you could argue, well, you guys, your districts are on the west side of the county, but I don't look at it just as being my district. I look at it as I'm responsible for all areas. And so maybe it's just communication, which that's been a thing that I've talked about before. Yeah. Maybe what needs to happen is just communicate, you know, an email so that, the three of you are involved because you're on the committee and these are the schools currently sitting in your zones or your districts or whatever, but you guys all seem to know, and I'm not speaking for room, I just felt kind of left out. And then I got phone calls from people asking me questions, you know, saying, well, they just came in here the week before Thanksgiving, and this is what they said, and then questions couldn't be answered that they had either. And so if I had just met, and I couldn't answer their questions or anything because I didn't even know you were going in and doing meetings and telling them.
Okay, point well taken. And so we can, that's an easy fix, and we apologize.
And I'm not asking for an apology.
I understand because that happened. I don't care what the issue is. Sometime they'll call us, and I'd be like, I had the slightest idea what you're talking about. So I get it. I get it. Okay. Any other? You can continue.
How about if we move to another part of the county?
That sounds like
we're
a winner.
We're taking a five-minute break.
Okay.
Just explain this a little bit, because if you go back and just talk about what could be, and we will not ask questions, honestly, I promise.
Yeah, we, you know,
back to the next slide. go back to your previous
back
slide?
To the next slide.
The previous.
Okay.
So every year, I just wanted before I got to jump in real quick. Sorry.
Okay.
But every year we bring a 5-year plan, capital plan,
correct,
forward. That's the time when we present that for discussion. Some of the things that have been on this 5-year plan have been in the works for 5 years. So we're just not coming up to it. So some of your board members are going to be brand new with the projects we approved last year, a year before, 3 years or 4 years ago as well. So that's a perfect opportunity, I think, for us to maybe re-educate as well.
Sure.
This is where we were at that point in time 4 years ago. This is what this board did. This is where we are today. So I just want to kind of bring that out. It's something we do. So we got to pay more. All of us have to pay more attention to that when we bring those projects forward.
Okay, so to summarize the issues that will be evaluated as part of the Osceola Master Plan, mm-hmm. I think that's what you asked me to do?
Yes.
Okay. So the issues that will be evaluated are a potential consolidation of Ortona and Elementary on of Ortona
and Osceola,
On a campus. Which campus is unknown? That's part of the evaluation. In addition to the traditional K-5, we thought we heard, please evaluate a K-8. So that evaluation will occur as well. As part of the workshop today, I thought it was important to highlight the issues of attendance zones as it relates to these two areas, because the attendance zones for the areas associated with Osceola and Ortona illustrate a number of different issues that I thought would be important for the board to consider. And one issue we have talked considerably about, those associated with zones where children live further away from a school than perhaps the neighborhood school. And then the other issue relates to a feeder pattern. Mm-hmm. And whether or not a feeder pattern is something to be addressed or not, again, my point today was to highlight some of the issues associated with a study that is imminent.
Okay.
All
right.
Okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Moving into Southeast, we have... I'm going to try and move us forward a little bit. So certainly at the elementary school level, we have a lot of choice in Southeast, both in terms of the district's choice program through controlled open enrollment or variances, as well as two successful charter schools. So pretty much we receive applications in this area at the elementary level and we're able to approve. New Smyrna Beach Middle School, we don't have what we call available capacity. Now, that school is also in your CAPS program and ready for some significant renovation. And certainly as part of that renovation, you know, we'll be able to look at some spaces in more detail and address not just the system issue of HVAC, but overall conditions of the school. But the highlighted area that I wanted to talk about, I really want Mr. Cologne to be here. Take us to the next slide. I know he's reviewed this. Do you think we...
You want to take a break?
Should we
take a
break?
5 minutes.
Take a break.
In our workshop. And Ms. Sara Lee will continue.
Get her hammer.
All right.
Go right ahead.
Okay. This next example is really a segue geographically between Southeast Volusia and Southwest Volusia. And the reason why I wanted to highlight it is not to say it's on our schedule to redistrict. It is not on our schedule, but I think this is extremely interesting and unique in terms of feeder, because it's probably the most unlikely feeder that we have. So this zone that's shown in front of you on this map is Pride Elementary. And Pride Elementary is one of our newer elementary schools in Deltona. What's interesting about it is when we look at the middle school zone associated with that same attendance boundary, you see that Pride's zone is split zone between Heritage Middle School, which is very close to Pride Elementary in Deltona, and the northern part is Creekside Middle, which is a middle school in Port Orange. What makes it more complicated is when we look at that same area at the high school level. You see the area that is Pride and Heritage is zoned to Pine Ridge. That's a nice, clean feeder. All Deltona schools. But the area that is Pride and Creekside is now New Smyrna Beach High School. So it's that area where we have created attendance zones to three different schools in three different communities. And I'm not really sure of the how, except I think, because this was before attendance boundaries moved to my department, I think that this was associated with Pride opening and Sam Sula closing.
I was here then, and that's exactly when it happened.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
This is right.
Yes.
So this one I didn't know about till we got this. Like, I didn't realize the Sam Sula kids were coming into Pride. I was very surprised when I saw this. So here's my first question, and maybe you can't answer it today, but Greg, maybe you can, because you were in transportation at the time. So those kids that are coming to Pride that are clear over there sitting between where Cypress Creek Elementary and Chisholm Elementary, like that, really even that top, you know, piece there, how long are they on a bus?
Yeah, so long time. So the first student we pick up actually is farthest away from Timbercrest, correct? So they're on the bus for about 50 minutes, easy, and we'll pick up everything on 4:15 going up to Pride Elementary School. Then when you start looking at the middle school and high school and how we divide that up, it's a long ride because we got to come all the way back to Deltona, then back down and back into the schools that we go into, which would be Creekside, and then back over to New Smyrna Beach High School. So those are long routes. I mean, they are. Some of them are over an hour.
So we've got elementary kids that we're picking up there in that top part.
Correct.
And they're on a bus for basically, on average, an hour.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. To take them into Pride.
When looking at this area, I specifically separated between Creekside Middle and Heritage Middle and looked at that, what is actually the Lake Ashby neighborhood. The majority of the kids who are zoned to Pride in this northern section that it goes to Creekside and New Smyrna actually go to some of the charters in the southeast and some of our traditional schools in the southeast. Mm-hmm. There is only a small portion that chooses to go to Pride. So even though it is a large, a long transportation, as a long drive, there were about 15 students in this large area out of, was almost 100.
So 15 go to Pride?
Yeah, 15 right.
15
for us to
in this zone that is look as Creekside on the map now.
Okay, so I want to go to what you said. So we've got, so let's just roughly say we have 100 kids. So 85 of them are choosing to go to the charters over in the southeast, which could be Burns or Sam Sula.
Or
some of our other schools in the south.
Or they're going to the traditional. Okay, so they're going to the traditional even though they're not zoned. We don't have them zoned. Mm-hmm. So they're getting variances that we are approving to go mm-hmm. to the traditional. Mm-hmm. Are we busing them then to the, like, are we busing them to Coronado? Which
no. not unless they're going to, like Greg mentioned, the closest available stop. Right. We don't have a bus that comes out here to take them to Chisholm, Reed, Patillo, Coronado.
So actually, when you say choose, really the 15 kids that are left, it's not really that they're choosing. It's just they're zoned for Pride, and we offer busing service, so that's where the parents are sending. Because the parents aren't doing, those 15 parents aren't doing a variance to stay at Pride. They're just not doing a variance to stay near where they live or to go to a charter school.
True.
Right.
So there's really not a choice there. We can't just say 15 are chosen. Really, no, those 15 are going with what we set up and what we created.
Correct. They're following the zone.
Yes, ma'am. 85 have chosen to do
something different.
Something different.
Because it's better for their, they don't want their child on a bus for 50 minutes.
Or for whatever reason.
Whatever
yeah.
reason.
Multiple reasons.
But then they don't go to Deltona for middle school and high school. They stay on the east side.
Yeah, most of the ones that are in this area end up going to Creekside Middle, probably because it has a very good reputation. So why would they choose something different?
Well, no. We zone them for Creekside Middle.
Correct.
We send them to Pride, 50 minutes to an hour away. And that's
Creekside is also quite a bit away as well.
Just north of that, right. Northeast.
But then we send them to Creek, and once again, it's not a choice. We've zoned them for Creekside Middle.
Correct.
And then we've zoned them for New Smyrna Beach High.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well,
right.
Yes,
and
it's zoning, but they are choosing not to take advantage of other options.
For whatever reason. But the point in bringing it forward was it's
where we
kind
are.
Of
another
bizarre.
It's where we are. It's right. Another area that
yeah.
you know needs further observation, discussion.
Like I said, I was surprised
resolution.
By this one. This
right.
one.
Well, you'll be surprised right. at several different things.
And so, I found.
No, go right.
I found it ironic that I'd never heard anybody complain or mm-hmm. anything one way or the other, and
right.
that's because there's only 15 who are actually going with their zone school.
Out of the top piece.
Out of the top piece,
right. Correct.
And so, you know, I think we do need to keep an eye on it, especially with the growth over by Pride, with the houses that will eventually go in. They've cleared all that. And, I mean, there's only like 7 houses right now. I think they've sold like 10, but it's at some point we'll reach the 200-some-odd mark. This is a very rural area, mm-hmm. and the highest concentration of homes is on the northeast side of that, and I actually had to go back and look at our maps because a lot of this is in your district. Because I cut off on part of 415, headed right a little ways before 44.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you're not hearing anything, I'm not hearing anything. You know, it's probably something to keep an eye on, but.
Yes, Ms. Haynes.
Is there a possibility, just saying, that we've lost some of those students to the charter schools because otherwise they were going to be on a bus for an hour?
Certainly.
I mean, let's
could be multiple reasons, but that could be one of the reasons. I'll put it that way. So transportation is always one of the reasons why someone chooses.
Certainly, Sam Sula is not far
right.
from this area. Burns is quite a distance further than Pride would be.
Right.
And closer to Deltona, you know, it's easier to get Ivy Hahn.
And I think many of the families who attended Sam Sula Elementary, once it closed,
right.
they really want their children, again, to be in their neighborhood school. I think it's more so that. And busing, yes, but I just think they wanted their children as close as possible. Yes, Ms. Cuthbert.
A
lot of the families here, much like Southeast Volusia, are generational families. Mm-hmm. And the kids who go to Sam Sula Academy, parents went to Sam Sula Elementary. Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think when the second phase is finished at Chisholm, which is next year, I think maybe we will be looking at this in the future to see maybe some of those northern kids going to Chisholm, which will have plenty of capacity mm-hmm. for them. So that's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. But we have to wait until that second phase is finished. And that's just a year away.
Yes. So.
And that would be a possibility. We could re-look at that zone and be able to rezone that area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's move to the west. And the two issues associated with redistricting / rezoning are the two issues that we brought forward last month in November, and we're continuing to recommend that these would be appropriate for us to pursue. Certainly, the West is a very large zone. Don't need to tell you that, do I? And there's considerable activity from a construction standpoint, but it does primarily impact the Manatee Cove and DeBerry Elementary zones and Blue Lake and Freedom in DeLand. Wanted to follow up on some comments that were made at the November workshop and asked Eric to provide you all with some information that relates to ultimately anticipating the impact associated with not just new residential, but enrollment trends, because the enrollment trends may not necessarily have anything to do with new residential, just maybe neighborhoods that are changing. So I asked Eric to put something together that speaks to our student generation rate and his work with our local governments.
So what I've tried to put together here is a little bit of a math problem, but in a way that everybody can follow. When we're doing student generation rates, that's for our reviews for local residential development. We do them for a county-wide student generation rate. So what I'm showing you is an example of our county-wide student generation for a single detached home. It is 0.27 throughout the county, which would mean for every 100 houses, that is 27 students total. And then we would have to break that out into elementary, middle, and high. Generally, elementary is around 45%. It fluctuates a little bit in the different areas. In the west side versus the east side, it might be 46 one, 44 in another, but it's very close. So out of 100 homes, we can expect approximately 11 students to be entering the zone school. And in that 11 students in the 100 homes, I actually met with the planning staff over in DeBerry Friday so I could get as updated information as possible. It's going to take anywhere between 1 and 3 years to build 100 homes in one of these locations, right? I did an example. I went and researched Riviera Bella when it began, how many units were approved, what state it's in now, and how many more units are still to be built. So in 2007, 12 years ago, it was approved for development. So over those 12 years, it had to go through design and platting, and then the horizontal infrastructure like your roadways, sewer, water, all of your fiber optic, before they start construction of the homes. So that usually takes between 1 and 2 years to get that done after the planning stage. They've already got their approvals for the number of units and the type of land use, things like that. They're just coming in for their actual design at that point. That's going to take about 2 years. So a 700, Riviera Bella was 708 approved in 2007. That year, from this specific area, and I'll show you this, this is Riviera Bella, this far west yellow piece. We received 7 students in the elementary school for the opening year of their construction. So that was within the first 20 days they had people moving in. Right. This year we have 80 students in the elementary, which is a higher than the 2.27. That's actually 80 students out of 397 complete units. That's I think that was around 40%, 22% of the total number of units. So that is actually a lot higher. But where we're seeing the most of the number of students coming in to the schools, to DeBerry Elementary, is in the existing housing stock, places like DeBerry Plantation and Glen Abbey. And so DeBerry has changed its format. I guess it's become one of the places that people are finding more desirable for families. It used to be a very old place.
Senior.
Not very old.
Senior.
Okay.
Senior
place.
Senior. Isn't that where Jamie lives?
Where Jamie lives.
Excuse me. Go ahead, Ms. Haynes.
I'm going to help you here. I've been there 33 years, okay? So 33 years ago when I went there, the ball field is where Winn-Dixie was, and they were just going to build Winn-Dixie, which threw the older community into, you know, because there weren't many kids in DeBerry 33 years ago. They went to Enterprise Elementary. There was no DeBerry Elementary. I helped open DeBerry Elementary. So I know this area very well, and what I'm going to say about Riviera Bella is it's an anomaly, okay? So when you look at it and say, yes, they planned for 708 units, and there's still 300 to be built, and you know, we've got 80 kids coming out of there. First of all, the cost of those homes is not a home that most families can purchase. You have to have some wealth to live in Riviera Bella, just like you have to have some wealth to live in certain sections of the gated communities of DeBerry Golf and Country Club. So when I came to DeBerry, there was no DeBerry Plantations, no Glen Abbey, no Golf and Country Club, no Riviera Bella, none of that. Yes, it was older homes that were built in the 40s and 50s, and that's predominantly, you know, where, and families were starting to move into that area. This is what one of my sixth graders told me. Welcome to DeBerry. You know, like that's what the kids thought of it even. So, yes, we've got families. But what I'm concerned about, okay, and what I brought up last March when the city of DeBerry approved this, and I meet with this, I know the people at the city of DeBerry on the council, and I know Carmen back even from when he was the mayor and we became a city. It's the apartments that are going in. Okay, so DeBerry Elementary at one point in time, because we built it and it's landlocked and it was our first two-story elementary school, it has never, ever held all of the kids from DeBerry. Okay, when we built it, it couldn't hold all of the students in DeBerry. We were sending them to Enterprise. I was at DeBerry Elementary even when we did double, like we had 36 kids in every kindergarten through second grade classroom with two teachers, because there was not enough. We could put all the portables we could put on that piece of property. It's landlocked. You know, I told, Reuben called me and asked me a question about it, and I said, look, where the elevator shaft was and the stairs, We built a building around that to hold more students. We opened Manatee Cove and sent the north end of Orange City, the south end of Orange City, back into Manatee Cove. The problem is we're going to head back into 36 kids in every classroom with double teachers if we don't start talking about, because those apartments, he drove down there and saw them.
It's a village.
Drive down 1792 and look to the left of the Sun Rail, and that just gives you a hint of what's coming. And yeah, the 700 homes just got approved for Fort Florida, and I don't think those homes are going to cost what Riviera Bella is costing. I may be wrong on the 700 homes coming in, but those are families. So I appreciate your every 100 homes may get us 27 kids or whatever. That's not. Okay, if we were building back in the 50s like what DeBerry was when it was Dedbury, yes, then I'd say we would get 27 kids, but that's not what we're getting now. And we are landlocked, and already we send a huge portion of DeBerry over to Enterprise. But we've got to talk about what's coming. Now, Riviera Bella got stalled because it was also during the recession piece, and people weren't buying $400,000 homes and $500,000 homes. But, you know, and DeBerry is, we're a bedroom community to get on I-4 to go to Orlando because mm-hmm. we are the closest spot.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things we learned, was it Wednesday or Thursday, Florida has now regained its strength as being one of the states with the fastest growing population.
Yes.
We have considered ourselves fully rebound from recession as of 2 years ago. But when we looked at the list of the top 10 cities, it is actually Deltona and DeBerry that are one of the top 10 fastest growing cities for families. Mm-hmm. And we got to keep that in mind. We talk about the east side. We know Brown and Brown is bringing 600 people here, but many of them may choose to live on the west side of the county versus living on the east side.
Well,
so
you have Amazon coming
I think
as
that's
well.
Good information. Amazon. I didn't hear you, Greg.
Amazon is coming as well.
So. Yeah, and Amazon. And so
there's several businesses.
And so with people finding it attracted to live in Volusia, that's one of our sticking points. They'll live here, but they'll go everywhere else and work. But it is easy for them to cross over and go to Seminole and Orange County to work.
Right. Also hurts.
And the area reminds me of what happened in the late 1990s in DeBerry, especially, but Southwest in general, that was when it exploded. And both communities, Deltona is considerably younger than DeBerry when you look at median age.
Mm-hmm.
But both communities are suburban communities for the Orlando employment market. The ease of access, whichever person said that, is we have a lot of migration Monday through Friday from these two communities, and we are more affordable
than
where they're working.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I see happening. Mm-hmm. Eric's comment about he sees a lot of the enrollment increase associated with existing housing stock. It's because these are nice communities, very affordable, and more affordable than what they would have closer to where they work. So, so in terms of addressing the future, right, besides just monitoring, we did identify the one area that if we approach it now, it's more of a proactive change. Eric identified four children that reside in that total area, only one of whom is in the elementary school at DeBerry. And so our recommendation would be that we grandfather that student. This particular change would be relatively easy for us to implement. We actually spoke... I spoke with Carmen Rosamund. I met with him recently, and Eric meets regularly with the planners. So we've talked about what they're doing in their community with new and what our potential responses can be. terms of identifying other areas is where it starts to get a little bit more complicated if we were to pursue more rezonings. That other area that's closest has many, many, many children and families in it. And I'm not advocating that we approach it, the area between Enterprise and State Road 17. I am not advocating, and I am not recommending that we move into that area. I don't think that is something that we should pursue. But when we were evaluating, well, what else? What else absent? We definitely don't want the school to lose its area for recess. You know, we can move. We've identified the ability to move two more portables in, which will give them a total of six. But
that's
my personal
Enterprise?
I'm
no,
sorry.
No, this is DeBerry.
DeBerry has no land.
But it's a constrained site. I would call it a constrained site. And then we looked at the Island of Growth, which was those 700 units that you referred to. And we've looked at, I know you don't like the word island, but it's an island of growth because it's separate from everything else that's contiguous to it. And we have done something similar in the Port Orange area. At this point in time right now today, given where Eric said this was, I would want to continue to monitor. I'm not necessarily advocating it today. However, I would want to continue to monitor our enrollments and see how the economy continues to move and absorption. And that could be another area we look at. I think we need to be careful how big we decide to make Enterprise Elementary.
Well, since I've taught at both schools, started my career at one, watched, you know, what used to be the cafeteria become the front office and then, you know, add on the other buildings, and then I helped open DeBerry Elementary, I have a clear understanding of both facilities. I just know this. DeBerry Elementary, we can't go back to the point of double classrooms. When you put 36 second graders in one of those classrooms, even though you say, I put two dynamite teachers in there, you just can't move. I mean, and we've already lived through that. At the same time, you know, with Enterprise, you know, I was at Enterprise before Deltona existed, and as far as schools, and, you know, we were between 1,200 and 1,400 kids, and the playground was a sea of portables.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that was before mandatory recess.
Correct. That was. And so, you know, I see both parts, but those apartments are opening. And we can't wait and say, well, where are we sending those kids? My thing is, you know, you've got 1792 is the nice dividing line. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got the west side and the east side. The west side has DeBerry Elementary sitting on it. To the east, we do have Enterprise Elementary. I mean, I know what you did up there because you didn't want to touch Glen. Like, Glen Abbey would be a whole. But you did still pick up as far as using High Banks. Mm-hmm. You still did pick up a piece of purple out of that old, and that is families in that older section of there. But We got to talk about the apartments. The apartments, they built them quickly, and they're sitting across from the SunRail, and there are going to be some families in there where they get on the SunRail to ride down.
Well, isn't that the area that
this is the area we're talking about?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So this is the area that we're saying okay. We should pursue.
Is it this one?
Is it this?
This is the apartments.
Oh, the little comma down there.
That's the apartments.
This yellow piece is the apartments.
It's right
this
across from the SunRail.
Blue piece here is called the Junction. It
yes.
isn't in the stage where they're building yet, but they are getting there.
Because that's Gemini Springs there, which is where we looked at years ago building University High, and mm-hmm. instead it went to Orange City because Gemini was going to be a park and stay a park. And now they're building out on parts of it. So. But the apartments are the thing. They're getting ready to open, and where are we putting? Where are we going? And I know Reuben has some different feelings about it, but my thing is also, you know, how far are we busing them? Are we crossing the highway? Are we staying on one side of the highway? What are we doing? But DeBerry Elementary can't, I mean, there's not a lot of way, I mean, we will be going back to double classes. And
so,
that's not
so
what's
we're recommending us. That we move forward on this one.
Right, for a reason.
So going back to what I said before, I want to see what the potential educational impact is going to be, number one. Number two, it looks really little in yellow, but these are 5 3-story towers with 289 apartments. I think the highest priced one is like $1,200 a month, so that's affordable housing. I don't know that Enterprise can absorb those children without it being, I mean, Enterprise is an old school. And Enterprise, I don't know what capacity. So what I'd like to see is what we visualize that capacity being at. Are we talking about adding portables? Are we talking about, because, again, these we're talking about three law. I mean, these are huge buildings. I mean, 289 units, that's a lot. And so if we take it, and I think, and this is taboo, but I'll throw it out there, it almost looks like we may need another school somewhere in between here, because between Manatee Cove, DeBerry, look how much area DeBerry is covering, even though a lot of the stuff to the left is rural. But I don't know that Enterprise can pick that up. And I think it's unrealistic to think we're going to have 30 elementary school students. So no. I'd like to see what our other nearby apartment buildings look like, and how many students do we have in there in each grade. And so, again, we can take that offline.
Yeah. So multifamily places, it's 12 per 100 units. So if you're looking at
As an average.
But we have some apartments in the area that we can get the real student generation rate out of the apartments in the area. This will be a little bit different because of its, you know, what it's being marketed for and its location. But in terms of the whole area that we're talking about, there are no current students in the area that are going to be impacted. So the data we bring forward is going to be primarily student generation rate per units, and the other data in that area. That's what we would bring forward. Okay.
May I also say,
sure.
Our student generation rates were third party verified and developed. So even though we do look at things a little bit differently, we have a second opinion that does say that these are the generation rates throughout the district. I know that the impression is that there are more kids, and the closer you get to the school, you're going to see more kids per house. But when we're looking at, say 5 miles out, that contains most of the kids. 5 miles out from every one of our elementary schools contains 99% of our student population. So that is our 27 per 100, or that is our 12.7 per 100 for a multifamily. So the impression is a little bit different than the actual math when we go back and look at it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in looking at the apartments, you've got the ones there at Saxon, you know, which
mm-hmm.
are
that's one of the projects that we would look
probably
at.
More
right.
similarly priced, but you can't look at the 55 plus one, because
right.
what you've got at Saxon is you've got the family ones, and then you have the
right.
55 plus one. They look all identical, and then you've got the set over behind Target, but Target's a Section 8 and a lot more affordable housing than what we're putting in
right.
in DeBerry. I mean, and
right.
and the ones behind Target were marketed differently. They were marketed for lower income,
mm-hmm.
where the ones on Saxon were not necessarily marketed for lower income, and the ones in DeBerry are not being marketed as, you know, lower income. So I think, you know, we've got to look at the Saxon piece as more telling of like how many do we have living in the Saxon, and I don't remember the exact number of units, you know, that went into that set.
But we have that information. We can do that.
And we also look at, you know, the cost associated with what it's going to cost to rent. All of that's going to make a determination on a number of students or families that are going to be moving in here based on their income. So all of that's taken into consideration.
City of DeBary actually is expecting this area, because of its connection to SunRail, to be more professional, empty nester type of residence. It is one or the other.
Thank you for not saying senior citizen.
So, and then the last one that is the one that we've started a couple years ago, Citrus Grove and George Marks, and we would like to finish that one up. We want to do another notification, another community meeting, but prepare ourselves for the opening of George Marks. In discussing moving forward, we would anticipate bringing forward the formal recommendations to the board in February. Just so that you know, whenever we do a redistricting, it is considered a rule change. So the same way you all, whenever you're amending one of your policies and you have a request to advertise, and then whatever 30 days or 45 days, whatever the number of days is later, you'll have your public hearing and your final action. That's how the board processes on redistricting. So we would bring something forward to you in February. It'd be the request to advertise for both these, and then come back to you whatever the meeting is that makes sense in accordance with legal ad requirements.
Any questions about the last slide?
I mean, DeLand's known this. I mean,
right.
That part was George Marks. They shifted it to Citrus Grove when Citrus Grove opened, and everybody knew it was going back to George Marks when they got a new school. So,
and we've had, you know, we had a mass notification, and we've had two different community meetings. So we're, and I think I mentioned we opened up variances to families who might want their children to start at George Marks now. We had a few, I think seven was the number we had. So we had a few.
That was my only concern. And I understand that if they're a fourth or fifth grader and they've been there the whole time, but my concern was bringing, you know, at what point do we stop bringing in the younger siblings? Because what if there's a three-year-old at home and they're in fourth,
right.
You know, at what point do we say, no, you're now going mm-hmm. to George Marks because that's where you are zoned and that's where your neighborhood kids live and all that. Mm-hmm. So I'd like a clean cut on that at some point mm-hmm. so that those kids in that section go to George Marks and they're with their community.
Mm-hmm. All right. That concludes everything we have for you today.
Okay. Colleagues, any other questions? Have we addressed them all? Go ahead, Carl.
First of all, thank you. Great presentation. Very complicated issues here along the way. A lot of things to take into consideration. I just wanted to get back to the topic that you brought up, Chair, concerning the African American communities being bused all over the east side to various schools. And my concern is for the achievement levels of the students. I think we've had a noble experiment, if you will, for the last 50 years. Since we've integrated our schools, you know, there should be a tremendous amount of data. You know, have black children performed better in integrated schools than they have in their neighborhood schools? Do black children perform better when they have a black teacher in their life, particularly kindergarten through third grade, than those black children that never see a black teacher. I just think these are things that we can't deny the fact that we haven't seen the level of achievement that we would like. And I know there's a lot of factors that to consider. However, as we tend to look at this thing globally now, it to me, it seems like it may be the time to really address this issue and say, and just ask ourselves, are we helping these children or are we hurting them by sending them to schools far, far away from their neighborhoods? I mean, if it could be proven that they were at a distinct advantage over their peers who are still in their neighborhood at their neighborhood school, but they're not, these children who we send to Moca or Osceola or wherever, and they're doing way better there than their counterparts, then we have some kind of argument. Mm-hmm. I would still say it's not so much the school, it's always the teacher that the child has. But I just think if we get Dr. Fritz involved in this, and certainly ways to incentivize our best teachers to stay in our neighborhood schools, particularly African-American teachers, I just think it's time that we need to ask ourselves, should we continue doing the same thing that we have been doing, particularly if the results aren't what we all wish they would be? So, again, I'm not placing blame. I'm not pointing fingers at anybody. I'm just saying this may be a time to relook at that. And I know it's a huge, huge issue and a lot to consider, but I would certainly not be opposed to having that discussion and not be opposed to putting more money into Stark or Terry T. Small or whatever. I mean, we got to put the money in, and of course, you know how I feel. I'm not opposed to paying teachers more to work in neighborhood schools too. I mean, we got to do something to kind of turn this thing around, and I'll be open. And I know that you're going to want to weigh in at some point in this.
I just want to be clear. Yeah. The issue is a Halifax area issue.
Yeah. I mean, the issue that you pointed out right at the start. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know that. Mm-hmm. I just thought this was the time since you touched on it, Madam Chair. Otherwise, I wasn't going to bring it up, but since you opened the door a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Persis, for that, because I agree with your sentiment. I think we just need to look at some data and verify how children are performing and how they are learning and what can we do, again, to keep them in their communities, because I believe if we just look at that and not just on the east side, I think in our entire county, we could save money on transportation that can now help bring money back to the classroom. And that's the way, how do we bring money back to the classroom? Any other comments, colleagues? Okay.
While we're going, you said something that, too, we need to make sure we have the best teachers, but we also have to define what is a best teacher. A teacher can come in with high grades, scoring very well on the general knowledge test, but not reach children. I want the best teachers to be able to inspire, motivate children to learn. And it's been said, it's probably an old data point, but your best teachers are your high C, B people. It's people who can reach children. And as long as we can reach the kids and inspire them to be more than what they themselves think they can be, those are our best teachers. So we need help with finding those teachers, because a lot of times, and I know I'm one of them, we do not advocate ourselves. You know, we just do the job. We keep our heads down. We do the job. And we do not really ever pat ourselves on the back. And it's talking to other people within their own school community. And it's those who say, yes, I want to give more, but also those same teachers need to receive more. And it's not just in money. Money definitely helps. It pays the bills. But it's a pat on the back from their administrators. It's an opportunity to go to extra professional development. It's an opportunity, especially for teachers. We have a lot of couples who are all teachers in our community. It would be lovely to have them be able to send their children to our extended day at a reduced rate, especially when we are talking about Volusia County teachers. Some incentive for them to stay, for them to encourage to work to schools. And sometimes they may live in a neighborhood and have to, their children go to a neighborhood school, but then they teach across the county. So we have to make sure that our employees are in, especially when they have younger children, are teaching in an area that they too can support their own kids, not just the children they have in the classroom. But I think by defining what our best teachers look like, I think that would be a huge step, and that can only move us forward. Thank you, okay. Madam Chair.
Okay. And so now, Dr. Fritz, now that you've heard all of our views, I want to hear from you, and I'm turning it over to you.
Yes, ma'am. First of all, I'd like to thank Greg, Sara Lee, and Eric. I will share some of the challenges that you pointed out. They shared with me this week as well as we were going through this, pointing out that these are areas to pay attention to. So I want to make sure that I do a comprehension check with you a little bit and make sure that I heard some things. We believe as a school district that children have the right to go to their neighborhood schools. I heard that very loudly and clearly. And when feasible, we should be looking at holding neighborhoods together so that when we're looking at apartment complexes and areas that we're not dividing that up, and so that children can go to school, come home, and be in that community. I also heard a proponent for more choice opportunities in our district. It may absolutely help with some of this. And so I will share with you that we already have plans for a huge choice fair next November as part of our initiatives in this district. So would love to share more with you as we get closer to that, but that will certainly be something that we highlight our specialty programs. The other thing that I heard is that when we make these decisions, we really want to look at the data. We want to look at demographic data. We want to look at student performance data. And that's something that as we bring these recommendations forward, we want to see how our schools are going to perform, recognizing that that is also a moving target because we're dealing with families that move around. Bus times were something that you mentioned. As we look at this, how long are our students actually sitting on a bus and moving around our county? And I will share with you is what you're really talking about is a redistricting of elementary schools. And it may even be so that once we do that, we look at middle and high. And this is a long process. I will share with you with 45 elementary schools, that's not something you do in between this meeting and next. And so what I would want to do is work with staff and make sure that we developed a timeline and shared that with you and what that would look like. And here's what I think is really important. When you're talking about redistricting, it's really the exception, not the rule. The majority of our students are probably in the right school where they should be, mm-hmm. and they would stay because you don't want to create a mass panic that every family and members or community thinks that their students are moving around the district. What we're talking about is allowing those students to go back to those core beliefs, be back in their neighborhoods, and to be able to go to schools where their friends go and in their community so that we have that community feel. So one of the things that I'll do with staff is I'll meet. I was typing notes as we were going through this, and what I'll share with them is those expectations, and we will develop a timeline and then bring back a recommendation. But it is a domino effect. Once you start to redistrict at the elementary, then it will lead up to the middle schools and to the high schools. But that is a long process. And just to give you an idea of my history doing that, that's at least 3 years because you're dealing with three levels. So it takes about a year to get right for one level at a time. Madam Chair.
Any questions, comments for the superintendent? Anything else from our presenters?
Thank you for the
information. Thank you very much for the information, and we are adjourned.